I'm gonna get down to it. I'm gonna run right through it. I'm gonna be exactly what you want me to be. You know, it's been so easy since your love came to me. It's just something that I want the whole wide world to see. Now it's 100%. Now I'm entirely bent on winning. Now I'm really ready to fight. You know I'm totally psyched. You know I'm feeling alright. I'm totally psyched. I'm gonna keep on singing your song. I'm totally psyched. Filled with your power and mind. I'm totally psyched. That's right.
Welcome to that rare daytime PresbyCast, roughly 7.5 hours earlier than normal. We are sans Resby, who's a vital employee of his employer and keeping the wheels of commerce turning. He's not with us, but we're glad that we have three guests. If you heard that late 70s disco funk gospel number, totally psyched he was, and I guess we're totally psyched to have what I'll call the three amigos, or the Presbyterian poobahs, or something. Two of them have never been on the show before, except if you count the 30 times or so each. And then we love T. David Gordon. He's with us here too. So we have historians, authors, PhDs all around. Two are retired, and one is working on it. So I guess this, you know, the boomer hate will flow, and we'll deal with that as it comes. But we're here to talk about something, again, a subject we've never broached before, Machen. One letter. This qualifies as geeking out over an historical figure and even kind of a niche thing with him, his views, his correspondence with a weird Southern church pastor. But I think it's a very revealing and touching letter in some ways. And before we talk about what it says, I'll just ask you guys, we'll start with the Southerner, T. David Gordon. I mean, T. David, I recall you're from Virginia. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm a native Richmonder.
All right, so you're the bona fide Southerner on the call, except for me. But you know the history of the Southern Church, and just when you read this letter, I gather you found it to be interesting.
Yeah, I Machen had relatives in Baltimore and in Macon, Georgia, so his family was spread across both the Northern Church and the Southern Church. And, you know, many people for years said Baltimore is really a Southern city. It's just above the Mason-Dixon line. And there was a lot of truth to that, especially through the early part of the 20th century. Darryl knows more about that because of his work with Mencken. But there is a sense in which even Baltimore was sort of a Southern town in its ethos, I believe. And so I didn't find it surprising that Machen was interested in both the northern and the southern branches. That doesn't surprise me at all. I would have expected that. And so we know in both branches, south and north, modernism for some reason took hold of the foreign missions programs of both churches. Machen was in trouble with that in the north, and now he's got a friend who was in trouble with it in the south. It's a curious phenomenon. Maybe Scott or Darryl has an explanation for it, for why it should be that of all places, the mission field would attract those very missionaries who didn't seem to have a great deal of interest in an Orthodox gospel. It just seems a paradox to me.
It's where pragmatism goes, right? That's what pragmatism always, from the whole history of the church, going back at least to the early medieval period and the early medieval missions to Europe, those things were oftentimes very pragmatic. So it's literally a perennial problem of pragmatism. And once you become a pragmatist, then, you know, the message is already secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a short step from muscular Christianity to the social gospel. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily think that's the case, but that's what history tends to indicate, I think, for what it's worth.
Well, another perspective, though, on this is, sorry to cut you off, Chortles, but something I've still has baffled me in a way, but going back to 1869 and the reunion of the old school, new school churches in the North, the plan of union was remarkably Christian nationalist. You know, people might accuse me of having that too much on my mind, but it could be the other way around, that my historical work on the 19th century has led me to be much more worried about Christian nationalism surfacing today. And this, both churches, old school, new school, 1869, were very much committed to serving the United States of America and making it a Christian nation. Now, that's different from what Christian nationalists today are proposing, who want a Christian government, and they don't want the church to do it. But I do think that that is a kind of a version of transformationalism that was already in place in 1870, roughly. And so you go 55 years later, it's not at all surprising that people are beginning to rethink missions, whether domestic or foreign, in light of how can we serve general humanity and make the world a better place, which is eventually what happens with rethinking missions, the report that comes out in 1932 or three, I can't remember exactly, so-called layman's report, that also kicks off another phase of Machen's controversy with the Northern Presbyterian Church. So how this happened, though, back in the middle decades of the 19th century, and how the Civil War contributed to that, and the churches trying to maintain or have a hand in maintaining the peace and order of the United States, is, I'm sure, a factor in that. But in some ways, it's not surprising to me that 1925, this is a problem.
No, you, Daryl. That's interesting that you say that, because I'm reading Richard Burnett's book, and as I'm reading it, I'm thinking it almost seems like the old school runs out of gas, somewhat more quickly than I had thought, maybe, and that the Civil War, you know, really plays a huge part in that, in a way that's analogous to what happens, you know, World War One. After the war,
right.
People are sort of worn out and they want change, and the young people are impatient, and they don't want to, you know, make use of spiritual means. They want to change this world now, and we're experiencing something like that now after the global war on terror. I don't know exactly where young people are at this exact moment, but I'm confident that there was a reaction after the GWAT, as people say around here. We have lots of veterans.
And COVID, too. I mean, COVID was war in some respects.
Yeah. It's almost put a punctuation mark on the whole thing and exacerbated everything. But we were seeing, even before COVID, I was having conversations with young people who were telling me in precisely these words, "We can do the social gospel without losing the gospel." I had a young person tell me that. And I said, well, if you can do that, you'll be the first, because it hasn't been done yet. And I think that's both naive and arrogant to think that.
Communism hasn't been done yet either.
Exactly. Never mind. Well, and if you're not aware, and you men might be shocked at this, but I have had conversations with young people who had no awareness of the, let's say, 80 to 100 million people who were killed by the communists. They just, I had conversations with people who really had no knowledge of World War II. So if that's your frame of reference, and somebody trots out the social gospel, or you know, then it probably has more plausibility than it should have, because there's no framework within which to interpret it.
Let's talk about, I've got it on screen for those who are following along live or who will watch the video. Of course, there'll be a link in the so-called show notes that will have a link to the Substack that has all the images and the words. But let's talk about the aesthetics of the letter. You know, Machen had terrible handwriting. Those who tried to decipher it had a hard job. He was a pretty good typist, but this looks like it was typed by a man in a hurry. Not too surprising. A few corrections, not many actual typos. But at the top of the letter, he's penciled in, and it's his handwriting. You can tell by looking at his signature elsewhere. S-O dot, or period, as we used to say, C-H, Southern Church. So he must have had a file for the Southern Church. Now, this letter came to me from someone who got it from Grace Mullen, who's the librarian, long time at Westminster, I believe. What's that?
Daryl worked at Grace for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's now deceased.
Right.
But yeah.
But anyway, highly regarded. And they said that generally he filed all of his letters and correspondence chronologically. But this might mean that he had a separate file for the Southern Church. Not sure. So that's before we get into this, just need to say that the reason for my interest is that as a PCA person, it's fascinating to think what would have happened if Machen had responded positively to one of the multiple entreaties to come south to teach in PCUS. That's the denomination that became the PCA, or the PCA came out of, to teach in one of those seminaries, or to accept the presidency of Bryan College in Tennessee. I don't know that he was ever really tempted by that, but he certainly had the chance. And if he had come south, could he have done any good in the Southern Church? Would it have held on longer? But I think I'm learning over the years that it was much further gone by this, even this early date of 1925, and that's what we may learn from this letter, than I would have thought before. I mean, I think the Southern Church was barely, you know, 15, 20 years behind the Northern Church in terms of orthodoxy. So any thoughts on that before we go on?
Machen did give the Sprunt Lectures at Union Seminary.
And that's in Richmond, yes.
Yes, in Richmond. That's where I did my PhD, in fact. And he gave the Sprunts there in the 20s, and I think it was what became The Origin of Paul's Religion.
Yes.
Later in its published form. And I think it was just before or just after the Sprunts that the board invited him and the faculty invited him to join the faculty there in Richmond at Union, and he declined. That would have inverted the fact that, you know, 60 years earlier, Princeton had tried to entice Dabney away from Union up to Princeton. And there was kind of a tart exchange between Hodge and Dabney, because Dabney said that his addition to Princeton wouldn't have improved it any, but his absence from Union would have injured the then nascent seminary. And he said, conscience would not permit me to do that. So Hodge wrote him a second letter trying to persuade him. And Dabney was really tart there. He said something to the effect that only a wicked man would ask a man to act contrary to his conscience. So Dabney stayed at Union, and Machen ended up staying at Princeton until Westminster was founded. But yeah, there was real interest among the sort of old school sympathizers in both institutions. They had an interest in each other's faculty.
Now, Machen grew up in a Southern church there in Baltimore. There were Northern and Southern churches in Baltimore. And although a fairly new school church, I believe, Daryl probably could probably back that up. I mean, it had some old school heritage, but it was not some, you know, outlier in the PCUS, I don't think, in any real way. But I don't get the impression from reading this letter that he was regularly corresponding with people in the South. I think he probably got his knowledge through newspapers like the Presbyterian of the South that he references. But, you know, it's just interesting to think about how interested he may have been in the South and how much he actually knew. You have any thoughts on that, Daryl?
Well, one other factor to keep in mind here is, and Barry Waugh has done some work on this at his Presbyterians of the Past website, but Leroy Gresham, a cousin, I guess it is, of Machen, his dates were 1871 to 1955, was a Southern Presbyterian minister in Virginia at Salem and later in Norfolk. And that's that's a reason to think that the family connections would also have given Machen an awareness of what was happening in the Southern Church. And I can't find the other. I thought Barry may have written two posts about Gresham. Or maybe it's coming from the Burnett biography that Scott is now reading that I read a while ago, Richard Burnett's Machen's Hope biography. I think Burnett suggests that Leroy Gresham was not necessarily the most conservative of pastors. Why that's the case, he trained at Princeton University, and I think also at I'm not sure where he went to seminary. Union. No, he attended Union in Richmond. I don't know. They're just the trend. All the trends were going toward a more progressive, cultured, civilized kind of religion in the Protestant world, which made it not as sexy, not as acceptable to sort of go with the hard-won truths of the gospel or the simple truths of the gospel, which is part of the background of the fundamentalist controversy as well. The fundamentalists were insisting on, at times, fairly simplistic readings of Scripture and fairly fantastic readings of the second coming of Christ. And that was all the more reason for the mainline Protestants to go in the other direction toward the science, toward the culture, toward respectability. And Machen kind of got caught in between on that. But that's a long-winded way of getting back to the point that he was probably monitoring the church from personal and familial connections as well.
Yeah, and you get the impression from this letter that he kind of realizes he's on the outs. And the fact that he's going to be a pilgrim and a stranger has come home to him. And there's sort of the end of the letter, it's sort of, there's some pathos there and some humor, and you get that idea. So, yeah, I thought not only Orthodox doctrine was out of fashion, so were denominational distinctives. I mean, ecumenism was the rage, church union in the name of, evangelizing the immigrants in our country, and then on the foreign mission field, Scott, you mentioned pragmatism, but ecumenism, that drives pragmatism. And let me just quickly read this first paragraph, which is probably the longest one, and we'll react to it, and then we'll work through. Let's talk about who he's writing to. So I talked to. We were talking about this before we went on the air. Anytime you sort of start poking around in Presbyterian history, you find something weird. I think I coined the phrase, there's no weird like Reformed weird, but it's not anything new. It's been going on for a long time. So he's writing to this guy named Hugh Watt, W-A-T-T, White, Doctor of Divinity, Bedford, Virginia. This guy had been a longtime missionary to China. I think he taught at one of the seminaries. I don't remember. You can find his biography online. But he had written to Machen, And I think an article or a letter to the editor in this Presbyterian of the South newspaper kind of torched this off. And this guy was, he was conservative, this Reverend White. But his daughter became a faith healer and wrote a book that was very influential in the charismatic movement in the 20th century. And this guy, White, 3 years earlier, had published a book on demons and demonology. So this weirdness, you know, that would kind of go along with he could have been dispensational for all we know. You know, if he'd, right. he might have been in that camp. But just a strange guy. And so it kind of, you know, you think about the later history of the OPC, Machen couldn't be real picky about who his allies were. I mean, it just weren't a lot to choose from. Any port in a storm, and this guy was a little weird. So Machen writes to him, and I'll read a little bit. I'm deeply interested in your letter of December 28th. It's refreshing to get into touch again with someone in the Southern Church who understands how critical the situation is. The last edition of the Presbyterian of the South was just about the most discouraging reading which has come into my hands for some time. I think the provision of the Foreign Mission Board of the Southern Church that utterances of missionaries should not be subject to criticism until formal charges are brought is the most preposterous interference of speech which I ever heard. The same tactics were pursued by modernists at our last General Assembly. It really looked as though certain gentlemen had published their writings with the intention of concealing them from other Presbyterians. For my part, I think that when a man comes out in print, what he says is a fair subject of discussion for the whole world. And I'm interested, from the ecclesiastical point of view, not in a man's private views or in his personal relation to God, but in his public testimony. So there's some things never change. There are always people in the church who don't want criticism of great men, top men, useful men, leaders, and that was going on in the Southern Church and, of course, in Machen's church as well. So thoughts on the opener here.
I can't count how many times people have written to me to say, you shouldn't be criticizing this person or that person. Either A, you know, he's a minister in good standing, or B, you know, this is the stuff that belongs in the courts of the church, and or C, have you followed Matthew 18? Those are the things that I get. And I'm with Machen here. If I write something in public, it's in public. it's not private. It's not a letter. It's not, you know. And now, sometimes that doesn't work. I once wrote actually a surface letter to someone. And I said, you know, this is private. And then he proceeded to scan it and post it online. So it doesn't always work. But he's an unusual character, I think. But if you write something in public, it's subject to public discussion. And the appeal to Matthew 18 in that context has never made any sense. And when people say, well, you shouldn't criticize this person, he's a minister in good standing, I say, Jacob Arminius died a minister in good standing. And Pelagius wasn't a minister, but I think he was a deacon. And I think he died in good standing. I mean, nobody knows exactly what happened to Pelagius, but when Coelestius was brought before the synod in Jerusalem, they didn't convict him of anything. They said, we don't know what this is about. We don't even understand this guy. He speaks Latin. We don't have Latin. And you guys sort this out.
All right. So, Scott, what that guy did to you, we're doing to Machen here, because this was a private correspondence. And he pulls no punches.
We agree, at least I agree with what he's saying here. When somebody writes something in public, it's subject to public discussion. Right. And the idea that you can squelch that and say, well, you're not entitled to criticize something that somebody's written in public.
He's going to name names here, but he did that in, you know, letters and articles, and even in Christianity and Liberalism, he named some people. So he was not afraid to do that. But he proceeds to do that here. So before we go on, Daryl, any thoughts?
Well, Chortles, you commented in your notes on this at your Substack that January 1st was significant because it's the day that Machen died 11 years in the future. But it is striking to me just thinking, what do I do on January 1st, which is a holiday? I don't know if it was a holiday then. I don't usually respond to letters. But Machen was also a big football fan, and there wasn't television yet. But I'm thinking, and I just did a quick search. The Rose Bowl actually started in 1902, but it was an all-star game that occurred on January 1st every year. It wasn't until 1947 that the Rose Bowl started to host the conference champions, the Pac-10 and the Big Ten or whatever. But Machen was a huge football fan, and you could imagine him perhaps, if January 1st were a big college football day, being at a game. But no, he's laboring at correspondence, and I think you're right that he typed it himself. Later correspondence would have initials at the bottom of the typist who he used. Mm-hmm. But one other point to make about this first paragraph, which talks about silencing critics in the church, this is January 1st, 1925. The special committee of 1925 that Charles Erdman, don't be an Erdman, where's the horn? Come on, let's have it. Thank you. Charles Erdman, as moderator of the General Assembly, appointed the special committee, and that's part of what they recommended at the 1926 assembly, which is what Machen is worried about here, which is silencing critics. It's basically, if you're going to criticize anybody, it's got to be, you got to bring charges, in effect. And that was a really important turning point in the Presbyterian controversy. So that's kind of striking, all from that single date of January 1st, 1925.
Yeah, I just looked it up. It was on a Thursday, so it wasn't on a Sunday, which he wouldn't have. He wouldn't have listened to the probably wouldn't have listened to the Rose Bowl on a Sunday, but certainly might have on a Thursday.
But he would have listened to PresbyCast on a Sunday, which is my part of my Lord's Day routine when it's available.
So there's repentance for that. But you know, Machen caused people to work on Sunday because those broadcasts that became two or three books, The Person of Jesus and some of those other ones, and he was put up to it by students at Westminster on the WIP, of which there are no recordings in 35 and 36. You know, he had to go to the radio station after church and broadcast those live. So somebody was working.
No, that was self-service. It was self-service. He just went in, they gave him the key, yeah. He hit the buttons. It was all.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But
not in the 1920s, no.
Yeah. He was a city guy. So yeah, there are a lot of things to think about. I mean, when there's a significant figure, I mean, some people don't care, but I try to think, what would his world have actually been like? Because again, the past is another country in some ways, and we're trying to understand these things. All right, so he begins to name names. This is a very short paragraph. Let me read it, and we'll explain a little bit. And it comes back to something Daryl was talking about earlier. He says, "As for the adjudication by the board, that's the Southern Mission Board, or the presbyteries of the Southern Church." I can only say that an ecclesiastical court, which could clear Dr. Leighton Stewart, could clear anybody. Moreover, the action of the last Hanover Presbytery, that was, that's where he was actually, I think that's where he was licensed, but anyway, that was a Southern Presbytery, was so absurd on the face of it, and he's, Dr. Stewart was pronounced to be all right simply because he said he was all right. But as a matter of fact, practically all modernists are engaging in chicanery and deceit of the worst possible kind. So He is upset at the actions of the Southern Church in relation to John Layton Stewart, and he is an interesting character. He admitted in his own writings to be a modernist. He said, "I was trained by the conservatives, but I'm much more of a modernist." He said that in his own autobiography, his memoirs. He was very so. He was in China in the and he almost became he was like a citizen of China almost. He lived there for a long time, and he spoke Chinese. He had a Chinese version of his name. He was involved in a university which had a seminary in it, as near as I can tell, and it was a union seminary. We'll talk about those in a minute. But he was involved in Chinese politics. Now, this is before the communists took over. This was it was between the wars. There was a lot of intrigue going on. He was involved in local and national Chinese politics. He had his favorites, people he worked with, and he would become eventually ambassador to China from 45 to 49. He actually was in imprisoned by the Japanese for 3 years. So he was no coward. He was a tough guy, but he was if you Google it, if you look into it at all, the CIA and the OSS, which is what the CIA was before, and all the foreign intelligence agencies would use missionaries and cooperated with them. The State Department and the mainline headquarters would cooperate at some level, and he was much more than a missionary. He was much more than a professor. He was a mover and a shaker in the largest country in the world, and became more so after this. So, but that's not what Machen was concerned about. He may have been aware of all that, but he just considered this John L. Stewart, who was maybe the most prominent Southern pastor in some ways, missionary certainly. He was concerned that he wasn't Orthodox. And that he was cooperating. His efforts, his cooperative efforts in this northern southern seminary were harming the message and the mission. So he was tried. There was a trial. Someone in the Southern Presbytery, Hanover Presbytery, which is that in Virginia or is that in Baltimore?
Central Virginia. It's in Central Virginia.
Okay, all right. So they tried the man. Someone charged him with doctrinal error, and he got off. And Machen's thing was, as this guy was a great man, they said he was okay because he said he was okay. And we saw that in the Northern Church too. So I'd be interested to hear what you all make of this. And, even though this guy was far from believing in the spirituality of the church. The problem Machen had with him was his doctrine.
One of our recent graduates, in the last 2 or 3 years, is in the UK doing his doctorate on this topic. At least related to this, the way that the OSS and CIA co-opted American missionaries, and so I'm sure he's well versed in J. Layton Stewart, in whom I am not at all. So I think this is fascinating, but it was interesting to see how vehement Machen was about him, and dismissive in a sense of the presbytery and their inability to convict this guy. Nobody goes from being a missionary to ambassador without having some fairly serious connections to, and I would think even what we today call the intelligence community.
Yeah, and I made the point that some of these mainline guys, they looked like globalists, but they had a nationalist intent. I mean, the U.S. was becoming an empire at this time, and there was a, the war with communism was real, but it became the most important thing. to some of these people. And just as you had Rauschenbusch in the city, in the cities in the U.S., you had a sort of an international social political gospel that these guys were pushing. So, Daryl,
I mean, I dabble in 20th century foreign policy history, and I've done some reading about the Dulles brothers. John Foster Dulles. I can't get the what brought that back to mind was Carol Burnett singing a song about how she loved John Foster Dulles. It's a very funny song. It's on one of the sitcom or television shows in the 1950s. It's just amazing. But I'd never heard of Stewart before this letter. And now that I'm looking at a Wikipedia page, not reliable necessarily, but the page indicates that Time magazine and Henry Luce had a background as a missionary in China, or his family did. But Time magazine described Stewart as perhaps the most respected American in China. And then, according to one Chinese historian, the page adds, there was no other American of his ilk in the 20th century, one who was as deeply involved in Chinese politics, culture, and education, and had such an incredible influence. But it's also intriguing to think about how much the man to whom Machen is writing, what's the guy's name again?
White. It's White.
White. White was a missionary to China. White actually died in China. And White had to have known Layton. I mean, Stewart, sorry. And, you know, so was Machen actually stepping on White's toes by talking about Stewart this way? I mean, it'd be curious to know what if there was a follow-up letter from White, and if White is maybe trying to defend Stewart in some way because they had personal ties back in China as well. I don't know.
It's interesting that I'm looking at the same wiki page you are, and it says that he had connections, ties with leaders in the Nationalist Party, Chiang Kai-shek and Zhou Enlai, and then spoke the same dialect. Stewart, who considered himself, according to this, more Chinese than American, spoke the same dialect as they did. And he also taught, it says, and protected underground Communist Party members at a university, some of whom went on to become party leaders. So,
well, that's interesting because Mao actually wrote an article that taunted Stewart after the communists took control in 49, something like that, and he was the face of evil to the Chinese communist. And I think I read that most Chinese school children had to read this piece that Mao wrote about Layton Stewart. And he was considered a bad guy and a failure to, you know, because he didn't defeat the communists. But they say now they actually appreciate him a little bit because of all the educational work he did. So, you know, you hang around long enough, the winds change a bit. But, you know, we can well imagine Machen's view of a missionary who didn't do anything but cultural and political things, which it sounds like that's a good bit of what this Layton Stewart did.
I mean, look at the contrast between Layton Stewart, who's walking in the corridors of power, moving between a missionary position and becoming an ambassador, and almost certainly connections with the intelligence community, and where's Machen, right? Marginal, and eventually, you know, in 1937, on a train to Leith, North Dakota. Most people have no idea where Leith, North Dakota is. But I do. I have an idea where it is. It's pretty obscure. So the contrast between those two figures is pretty amazing. And so not to derail this, but, you know, you guys are probably aware that there's a lot of discussion going on now about a movement to reconquer the PCUSA, all in favor of, you know, recapturing the kind of cultural, I'm not supposed to say influence, my dear friend Harrison Perkins doesn't want me to say influence, but cultural effect, cultural leadership,
cachet,
whatever we might say. Once upon a time I would have said influence. I'm not going to say it now. So, again, to contrast that with Maton, he looks like Stuart, looks like a perfect picture of the mainline in the middle of the 20th century. What is he about? It's not about the cross. It's not about the resurrection. It's not about the gospel. At best, you know, he becomes an anti-communist. So that's good, and I'm certainly an anti-communist. I mean, I'm a child of the Cold War. I grew up with sonic booms overhead, B-52 bombers from what we used to call the Strategic Air Command at Offutt, you know, all of that, F-4s screaming overhead in Lincoln. Amen. So that's what does that have to do exactly with the gospel of the resurrection?
And what's interesting from a Virginian point of view is Hanover Presbytery was one of the most influential presbyteries at the time, and it covered nearly the entirety of the state. And I think it actually leaked north into Maryland and south into North Carolina. It was founded in 1755 by Samuel Davies, of all people. And so it was a very influential and once extremely orthodox presbytery. So it's very interesting that then there, you know, Richmond, of course, would have been under its jurisdiction also. And, you know, Richmond, Virginia, in the 1730s was not a liberal place. It is a very conservative place. And Hanover Presbytery was a very conservative and influential presbytery. And yet they cleared Leighton Stewart. So all of that's sort of surprising to me.
I meant to say this earlier, and I just want to say it quickly, maybe get Daryl's reaction. To go all the way back to the beginning for just a minute, you mentioned the medium, the fact that, because I've got the typed letter in front of me, that you know, Machen typed this. Daryl, am I right to remember that Machen wrote someone, he's in a hotel, he's writing, and he's complaining to someone about somebody in the floor above him making a racket with the typewriter?
Yes. Yes.
So he must have given in at some point.
Maybe he didn't take his typewriter with him to a hotel, but an office, it's one thing.
I suppose maybe that's the case. He wasn't opposed to typewriters in principle, just in hotels.
Right. Right.
Okay. That's interesting.
Back to the point though about. I mean, that I was making, I found something else. The point about how cultured and established Presbyterianism was, I found a review of Stewart's 50 years of service in China. The review is written by Kenneth Scott Lauderette, who was like the dean of the study of church history the first 50 years of the 20th century. I can't remember where he describes Stewart. So somebody else should step in. While this is not good radio, if I'm going silent, looking for the. Oh no, Stewart loves and is loved by thousands of Chinese. This is Lauderette writing in the New York Times. He combines the charm and perfect manners of the Southern gentleman with Chinese courtesy at its finest. He has a deep interest in individuals, lowly or high, etc. Anyway.
So he attracted the attention of a very significant figure, right, in church,
right.
In historical circles. I think Lauderette was maybe the second president of the American Society of Church History. Schaff maybe was the first.
Maybe right, yeah. And to have your memoir published by Random House, which is what we're, and then reviewed in the New York Times.
So we really are talking about
that's not nothing.
Yeah. Machen gets published by Macmillan. This memoir gets published by Random House. We don't really have, for the most part, we don't really have access to those presses anymore. Does anybody, I mean, you get published by university presses, does anybody from our world get published in, big New York City publishing houses?
Well, Tim Keller did.
Okay. All right. That's a good point.
Yeah.
And maybe Mark Knoll, George Marsden, maybe those guys?
Yeah. Knoll probably does. And
yeah. Marsden, maybe George Marsden.
At Yale. And,
yeah, that was the Yale Press, his book on Edwards.
But I'm thinking about the sort of big commercial publishing houses. And maybe they weren't that big then. I don't know. That's an interesting question. But I mean, just the fact that this stuff appears in the New York Times, right? That kind of Christianity has become marginal enough in our culture that it's hard to imagine that stuff appearing very frequently in the New York Times, especially now that, I guess, is Ross Douthat retiring or something?
No, he's going to 60 Minutes.
Yeah. CBS.
Oh, Barry Weiss hired him for 60 Minutes.
Yeah. Oh,
interesting. Oh, that'll make some heads explode.
Yeah, it already has.
That's fantastic.
All right. Well, I'm going to summarize this next paragraph, except for the last sentence, but it explains. I'm sure it refers to John Layton Stewart, and it talks about he read in the Southern Presbyterian newspaper about the action of the presbytery in clearing Stewart, who apparently, if you read this paragraph, he had been charged most likely for cooperating with open liberals and what Machen would call unbelievers. And they cleared him of that. He was told to go on laboring with these wackos because he might have, a positive influence on them. And Machen says, "Permit me to simply to say that in my judgment, we shall not bring the world to Christ by that kind of influence." There's your word.
Which has in quotation marks.
Yes, yeah, right. Scare quotes. Which involves disloyalty to Christ. The only hope, I think, is in faithful preaching of the gospel. And here's the kind of the pathetic part, whether those who help us are, for the moment, many or few. And he was beginning to realize how few were with him. So, Machen was remarkably consistent. He was concerned about missions, about evangelism, and about the impossibility of those things happening as they should without the true gospel and solid doctrine and belief in the veracity and power of the scriptures. So
this point gets lost a lot, that the formal grounds on which Machen was defrocked by the PCUSA is over how should we do missions. So I think that's really significant. And, people have made this point. Daryl's made this point. Others have made this point. But I do think we neglect it sometimes, that it's about what are we saying to the world? What is our message? What are our methods? And the end of this paragraph, I think, encapsulates some really important points. Again, I'm thinking about these reconquistas, or reconquistadores, right? They're going to take back the PCUSA. They don't seem to have any idea what the PCUSA actually believes, how it's structured, what its constitution is, what the status of the Confession of 1967 is, what the status of the Westminster Confession is, etc. Because none of these kids have tried to go before a presbytery and say, well, I actually believe in the resurrection, I actually believe in the Bible, and so forth. And in some cases, they seem already to have conceded some of the key issues. So I don't know, what good is that going to do? But Machen got it, that the point of being in the main line and or staying in the main line and working in the main line is, and he has, as as we noted, is influence. It's being in an acceptable, wing of the culture, having access to the corridors of power and all of that. And I get how attractive that is. I'm convinced that's why evangelicals are so taken with English Anglicanism, if that's not redundant. Why they love the evangelical Anglicans, particularly, as I do, mid-20th century Anglicans. Because it was true even when I was there. There's a kind of air of respectability as opposed to being marginal. When I lived in the UK, when I went into a dissenting church, you knew right away you were in a dissenting church. They made you know that you were in a dissenting church. They felt it very acutely. I was surprised by it. As an American, you know, coming from a place where all the churches are free churches, we're all dissenting churches in a sense. But in the UK, you really feel that. And I think here in this part of the 20th century, walking away from the mainline is something like walking away from the established church. In fact, Richard Ackerman, Redeemed Zoomer, uses that language for the PCUSA. He calls it the established church, which maybe in a way, de facto, it is in some places. Obviously, not de jure. But that's the choice that people have. Just to put it starkly, marginalization for the sake of Christ or compromise for the sake of, in air quotes, influence.
All right. So now we come to something, and this is one of the more interesting parts of the letter. We come to the parachurch and evangelical ecumenism. And I think what's implied here is that in the letter from White to Machen, he had suggested that the evangelicals, the Bible believers in the U.S., needed to form a Bible union, which was a sort of a fellowship, a cooperative effort of Bible believers. And Machen, he sort of said, to quote Bart Simpson, "Your ideas are intriguing to me, and I wish to subscribe to your newsletter." At the end, but he said it's not time for that. And I think Machen was probably pretty realistic about evangelicalism, even in his day, which is really evangelicalism is another word for revivalism most of the time. But let me read this short paragraph, and I think you'll see what's going on. "I'm very doubtful whether the time is ripe for the formation of a Bible union in America, at least of a union which shall extend into various churches. For the moment, I think we ought to fight each his own ecclesiastical battle in his own church. But that is only a tentative judgment. Your idea is a very interesting one." So he was a Presbyterian. He said that even a few times in Christianity and Liberalism, to him, biblical Christianity was Presbyterianism, and he did not want to mix it up with everything else. I mean, he corresponded with Lutherans, he spoke for the Methodists, he spoke in Baptist churches, he spoke in all kinds of churches in, 34, summer of 34 or 5 in England, in Scotland, and even in Wales. But he didn't want, I mean, this guy's proposing a sort of gospel coalition, and Machen was not having it at this point. So to me, none of the issues we face today are new. And I think we see that in this short paragraph.
Hey, Daryl, I see that there was at least by 1857, an American Bible Union. So I take it this fellow White is proposing something else?
Yeah, probably something new and improved and better and modern. But Machen was charitable towards others, but he was not ecumenical, even evangelical. I think that's fair. I may have you muted for noise, Daryl. Any thoughts on this?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. The Baptists had already formed a Baptist Bible Union around 1922 or 3 with T.T. Shields, a minister in Toronto, and the gun-toting pastor in Waco and Detroit. How you have
Frank somebody.
Yeah, J. Frank Norris. Thank you. And I wonder if White is thinking about a Presbyterian version of it, even though he doesn't call it that. Yeah.
Keeping up with the Baptists. Dr. Gordon, any thoughts from your more southerly perspective?
I don't know if it's southerly. It's probably more that when I was at Gordon-Conwell, that I was
not named after you, sadly.
No, not at all. That I reminded people it was an interdenominational seminary, not a non-denominational seminary, because most of us were in not denominations. We were not opposed to denominations. So there have been cooperative arrangements of Christian institutions. I'm sure, for instance, at Westminster, California, Scott, you must have some non-Presbyterian students there, and they're welcome to be there, that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
So I think there are certain kinds of cooperative efforts that don't intend to replace the church or do the work of the church. And when people try to find something that does the work of the church without it being itself an ecclesiastical organization, they almost always end up in trouble, whether it's the 19th century, the 20th, or the 21st.
Brad, this sentence at the end of the second paragraph, I don't know if you're there yet on page two. I think the notion that the Southern Church has no necessity for controversy is quite absurd.
Yes.
The church,
yeah, we're getting there. Yeah.
I don't want to get ahead of you.
Yeah, we're getting there. So, I mean, I just wanted to, I think there were ecumenical, evangelical, gospel coalition type efforts and issues even then. And I thought that was interesting from that paragraph. But let me read this next paragraph, and we'll talk about that because I have some biographical information about the person mentioned there as well. So Machen goes on, and this is the and he's wrong about some of the things he says here, and he's talking about the international, English speaking.
No,
English speaking and Dutch speaking churches. So we'll point out where he might have missed it, but he was dead on. In many ways, he says to his correspondent, as to your inquiry about the future, I cannot tell what will happen. The future is in God's hands. In Scotland, in the larger churches, the battle, I suppose, has been lost. So he was right about that. But in Holland, it was gloriously won. I don't think that didn't bear out, I believe, some years ago. So he's saying that... he's recognizing that except for some of the micro denominations and the Free Church in Scotland, that they've got big problems. He thinks in Holland they're on good footing, the Netherlands, the Dutch, but that didn't turn out so well. He says, I think that we ought not to despair about the preservation of the Christian character of both our Presbyterian churches in America. That would be the Northern Church and the Southern Church. Well, he was wrong there, and he would be sadly wrong about where those would go. But he was not an Eeyore. He was not a defeatist. He actually thought he had hope as late as the first day of 1925. Now, how long he kept it from there, it's hard to say. But he says, but it's going to be a big fight. So he's right about that, and he was going to be in the middle of it. A big fight in which prayer is needed as much as labor. Now, I've heard Machen criticized for not talking about prayer that much, but here we have an instance where he says prayer is as important as work in this church business. He goes on, I think the notion that the Southern Church has no necessity for controversy is quite absurd. A church which has within its bounds so subversive an influence as that of James I. Vance, for example, can hardly speak in that way. So that's what Scott referred to. James I. Vance was a longtime pastor with a short break of First Presbyterian Nashville. It was a Southern church, and he was he was really, I don't want to say, I don't mean this in the worst way. He was the first Tim Keller. He was all about the city and city churches and being for the city. In fact, that church, I think in the mid-50s, left downtown Nashville and went to the suburbs. First Presbyterian Nashville is not downtown anymore, but some stayed behind and they became Downtown Presbyterian Church. I believe that's what they're called, and they still exist, but they're very, very small, but still playing the for the city card. So James I. Vance is another name that he mentioned. He was very popular and well respected, but he didn't impress Machen because of his. In fact, I think in my footnote, let me pull that up. He said that he was responsible for. Or I read this elsewhere. One writer said that he did as much as anyone to introduce American Presbyterians to the social gospel. So he was also not a great guy, at least in Machen's perspective. So Machen's naming names, and his targets are not altogether surprising. So, and he knew that the Southern Church was in trouble, though he expressed optimism. So his prophecy record here is about 50-50, which is about as good as it gets.
Looks like Vance was connected to the Federal Council of Churches, and I see it looks like there's some connections with Universalism and maybe even Unitarianism. I can't tell, but certainly it looks like he was an important part of the Federal Council. So
yeah, he was with the Federal Council of Churches. The church in downtown Nashville, as Sean Morris just commented, there were very few churches built in the late 1800s, early 1900s, in what was called an Egyptian revival style. And it's just a bizarre, they retained it, and it's a bizarre look. It's impressive, but you wonder what in the world they were thinking. But that's that church. So
my son, an architect, they think some interesting things sometimes. We've had conversations about brutalism.
Yeah. Well, Resby loves some brutalism, but he's not here. So
Barry Waugh, again at Presbyterians of the Past, wrote an article about Vance. Mm-hmm. And these articles he's writing about these liberals make me worried about Barry. I kid a little bit. Barry's a good guy, but still. But he does list a number of Vance's books, and he also some of his individually published sermons. And one of those sermons includes this one entitled, this is all one title, Fundamentalism, Liberalism, Tolerance. You could see, I don't know, I think you could see exactly where that's going. And he's responding both to Fosdick and Machen. And I'd like to read that to see what he's up to there.
So as we think back, you know, we think, 100 years ago, especially 140 years ago, everyone was conservative and things were great. What was it about, even in the Southern Presbyterian Church with the Westminster Confession and catechisms and a great history, what was it that, I mean, was it simply the lure of respectability that made them go down these paths? Was it a moral panic about society, you know, immigrants and, I mean, we know that every war results in a huge moral decline afterwards. So there, I guess you could say the latter part of the 19th century, there was a lot of concern about morality and where the world was going, even though, you know, they were making money, there was some optimism. You have the progressive era, the capital P progressive era. We tend to look back and think, oh, you know, everyone was orthodox and conservative back then. Even here by 1925, and well before for this Vance guy and a lot of other churches, North and South, it was already, they were already going off the rails, and we forget that. I mean, why was it? Is it just the normal tendency of sinful people? I don't know.
Is the South kind of invisible for a while? It's the people who are writing the stories in the early part of the 20th century really probably aren't paying much attention to the South. I mean, when do people in the North actually begin to pay attention to the South? I don't know. Maybe not till the 1950s and 60s. Maybe that's part of it. I think it's interesting that from this letter, it seems like there are some pretty significant problems in the Southern Church, and yet the PCA doesn't emerge until 1973. It's almost 50 years after this letter. So that intrigues me. What the thinking was, was there a confessionalist movement, or were they or were they just sort of generically conservative? What was the dynamic between 1925 and 1973?
Well, I think there was a disconnect between rural churches and small, some kind of small deep South parochial cities, and in the cities that would become big and powerful, Nashville, probably Louisville, maybe Richmond, T. David, I'm not sure, but Raleigh. Cities like that, maybe even Memphis to a degree, but I mean there was progressivism there, and I think it was a big respectable city versus the small towns and rural divide, and I don't think they worried that much about each other, but Machen was obviously cognizant of all these things.
Yeah, and I would say growing up in the South, you know, I was born in 54. So one of the things I realized by the time I was in high school even is that if you were going to serve on the Chamber of Commerce, you'd better be a deacon or an elder at the Presbyterian Church. And so there was still that residue that when the Scots came here, the ones that didn't settle in Appalachia, you know, established colleges and universities and stuff, and they became the intellectual leaders of enormous portions of American culture. And I don't think any of them were ready to shed that sense of cultural big shot. They had been calling the shots for years. There was one of the relatives of the Greshams that was a judge in Macon, and was a very prominent person. When I was a youngster and visiting relatives there, there was a high school. It was a Gresham High School down there still. And so the influence of American Presbyterians, especially in the South, I think, was really profound. And I think they just weren't ready to let that go. I'm not sure they were conscious of their motivations, but I don't think they were ready to let it go. The influential people in most of the cities you just mentioned, Brad, they were disproportionately Presbyterian.
Cultural respectability was a phrase you used. Yep. I think that's really important.
Yep.
Well, and there was guilt over, I mean, guilt and you know, we talk about white guilt today, but there was guilt over the Civil War. And I mean, some people probably kind of sought solace in culture and thought, well, we can be as you know, as artistic and as sensitive and as learned as anyone, and maybe that's just part of it. So anyway, it's a motivation we all should watch out for.
No, it's a really good question, Chortles, and I mean, I think there's something that all of us would agree that it's better, it's preferable, at least on the surface, to be an insider, not an outsider. I mean, to be an outsider is to be in some ways marginal, pariah or something, and who would necessarily want that? I think each of the guests on this podcast and the host, maybe we've been a little ornery and curmudgeonly, and so we have some of some kind of temperament that makes it possible to be that way, but it's not enjoyable necessarily. But aside from that, I do think I wonder in the case of somebody like Stewart or Vance, how much they actually understood basic Reformed theology. Did they understand it? Did they actually have a clue that they were saying something that departed from that? I can't say that now. It's not what we need. It won't help advance the church in this community or whatever. But I still know that. I suspect they didn't. I mean, I've spent some time reading the sermons and some of the writings of the ministers at Machen's home church in Baltimore, Franklin Street Presbyterian Church. And something Norris Kirk, or I think was his name. It's just not that impressive.
Harris Kirk.
It's really
yeah.
Harris Kirk, thank you. Really sappy, sentimental, that's redundant, Victorian, moralistic. I don't have a sense that he really had the categories for trying to say something that was based in Reformed orthodoxy and still speaking to some of the questions he was trying to answer.
It only takes a single generation, right? Well, I mean, literally one generation between people who knew the catechism, believed it, and then stopped teaching it for a generation. And then the people who grow up in that generation where it isn't taught, it isn't really framing the way that we think about our theology, piety, our practice, our life, and then the people who grow up under that, their children, right, will be even farther removed. I've seen it, right? When I got to the council at Escondido, they had been in the CRC long enough that when I was elected to council, we'd have discussions and I'd say, well, the Belgic says, the canons say, the Heidelberg says, and back, now this is 25 years ago, I got funny looks. In what was a very conservative church with very faithful ministry, but there hadn't really been, as far as I can tell, a deliberate catechetical program. And actually, much to the credit of one of our associate pastors, Steve Donovan, he instituted program of deliberate catechetical instruction, and it made a huge difference. It's night and day, but it hadn't taken very long before the guys thought like evangelicals, right? We entertained momentarily, seriously, the idea of sending young people with youth with a mission to Mexico. And I said, no, I mean, maybe you're going to do it, but I'm going to vote against it. Our children don't need to become Pentecostals in order to become Christians. They need to be catechized, and they need to be instructed, and we need to love them, pray for them, and all of that. But they don't need to go hang out and sit around a campfire with Pentecostals practicing glossolalia in order to have a genuine faith.
Yeah, and people are hard on the PCA, but T. David knows this. The founders of the PCA didn't have good seminaries to go to. A lot of them were self-taught, and a lot of them were sort of half-taught. And actually, the PCA is more reformed in many ways right now than it ever was in the 70s. So we had a long way to go and have made some progress, I think.
Yep, I agree with you, Brad. The PCA is more reformed now than it was when it was founded in 1973.
Although the BBC rejects the idea that it is a state broadcast, when pushed...
Yeah, and if you all heard the Duncans on the show in the last couple of weeks, I think they made a strong case for that. All right, well, let's move on. There's a short paragraph where Machen refers to something that I could not quite figure out, a protest or a movement of some kind in Great Britain, which encouraged him. I couldn't tell if this was in the Church of England or among the nonconformists. But it didn't bear a whole lot of fruit. I mean, you had Lloyd Jones and you had Stott and people like that. But how much success they had is arguable. I think they had more success, more positive influence in the U.S. than they ever had in Great Britain. But let's move on to this next to last paragraph, which is really sort of moving and also humorous. And it, to me, it's the most important part of the letter. Let me just read it. We see this. We see he was ahead of his time in knowing that he as a Presbyterian was not really an evangelical, and that it wasn't simply for long-term health. It couldn't just be modernists or liberals on one side and evangelicals on the other, that there was more than that. So let me read that, and then we'll wrap up with this. Machen says, "Let me say in closing that I sincerely hope that the denominational coloring will not be lost. Church union in its existing form is thoroughly agnostic and utilitarian. There is great need, I think, for a strong church consciousness like that which is so salutary in the Lutheran Church. Someone suggested a while ago that there ought to be two churches, a modernist church and an evangelical church, but I think that there must be at least three churches, a modernist church for the modernists, an evangelical church for the evangelicals, and a Presbyterian church for me." And I can't read that without smiling. That's somewhat tongue in cheek. It wasn't just for him. It wasn't just for his Presbyterian, for his preferences. It was because he thought it was essential that a church be biblical. So let's talk about the sentiments that he expresses here. So you see, he talks about distinctives. That's denominational coloring. You know, that includes church government, worship, sacraments, all that. And then he talks about church union being agnostic and utilitarian, and that's what radicalized him in 1920, that issue. He compliments the Lutherans for kind of remaining their own thing, and then finishes up. So I'm sure there are things to be said about what he said here.
Well, it goes back in some ways to the point about being an insider, an outsider, and influence. But I think if you have a strong commitment to the catechisms and confession and polity and worship, you're going to be looking at other, even serious Protestants, as deficient in some way. They get certain things wrong because they're not doing it the Presbyterian way. And of course, Presbyterians would like to back that up. This is the biblical way as well. But there is a sense when you're really confessional that you're at odds with other groups. And that's why on the mission field, to sort of keep insisting on Presbyterian ways, or in an urban church setting, to keep insisting, if you're Vance, no, we really need to be Presbyterian. Those Methodists over there across the street, they're wrong. That's some ways a hard thing to do. But I mean, that really was what Machen saw as compromising the witness of the Presbyterian church, and then more generally of the churches in America. And so in some ways, this church union cooperation idea is another way of kind of making the insider group bigger. And boy, isn't it great to belong to a bigger group as opposed to a smaller group.
I did a piece recently on the differences between the CRC and about the sort of renaissance in the CRC, at least to some degree, of confessionalism, led by at least in part by guys who went to a confessional Reformed Presbyterian seminary and who are now have been in some positions of leadership, have organized and are consciously trying to return the CRC to a confessional position. And I got a heated email from a guy who had been CRC and I think now is RCA. And we had difficulty communicating because, and I didn't understand why until I got his third email. in which he says, now I understand why I was having trouble understanding you. You're talking about, and he used what I thought was very strange language about the visible church, about institutions of power and this and that. And he was talking about the institutional church. Yet the whole time I was writing about the institutional church, it seemed obvious to me. I'm talking about the synods and committees and institutions. And I didn't see how anybody could miss what I was saying. And he was astounded that I was interested in the visible institutional church, in which he had served for decades. Anyway, I'm so all that to say, contrast that attitude, that sort of dismissive attitude about the visible institutional church, with Machen's rhetoric here about the importance not only of the institutional church generically, but of I think implicitly, a confessional Presbyterian denomination. That, in other words, he has a very churchly outlook on the nature of the ministry, and I think implicitly anyway, the kingdom of God. That's how he thinks of the church. That's how he thinks of the mission and the ministry, is in terms of the visible institutional church. And the fact that and I'm very struck by the fact that he speaks of the evangelicals. Because in this period, well, a little bit later than this, you can find Van Til talking that way in the 30s. But I don't remember seeing that in Machen in print.
Yeah, me too. Which is why it stood out so much here.
Yeah, the evangelical. So that indicates a degree of consciousness that there is this group out there, of which I'm not a part exactly, which I found quite striking.
Well, I mean, he could be referring to Stevenson and Erdman and people like that who weren't full blown liberals. They just tolerated them.
The moderates.
Yeah, the moderates, yes.
The guys who go, to some degree, go along to get along in order to retain their cultural respectability.
Yeah, but so being a moderate's not always bad. And warning to younger people, if you live long enough, you'll probably become one. But that's just a warning. So, T. David, I was moved and amused by this paragraph. What did you make of it?
Well, first of all, it's one of those things where you say, "Gee, I wish I had said that." So, you know, initially, I'm thinking, "What a wonderful sentence, right?" There must be, you know. I think he was talking about within Presbyterian circles, by the way, right? So there's probably the notion that the modernists and the evangelicals within Presbyterians probably couldn't get along. I don't think he's saying in the United States there should be only three denominations. I think he means within Presbyterianism. And he thought the solution was to be genuinely Presbyterian. So he really is, though I'm not so sure if he was aware of it, but he really is, it seems to me, in old school Presbyterian. He would have been an old light had he been around in the 18th century, and had it been 1830, he would have been old school, because what characterized true Presbyterianism in America in the 1760s, 1830s, and today is there are those who believe in the means of grace instituted by the church for the church, and there are those who just don't. And so if you are of genuine old school sensibilities, you believe that the ordinary way God establishes his kingdom on earth is through the ordinary means of grace practiced in true biblical churches. And there are others who always think they've got a better idea than that. And we used to call them New Light, and then we called them New School, and now we call them broadly evangelical or whatever it is. But Machen's sentiments are exactly those of the old light and the old school. It's this unwavering confidence that God knows how to make his kingdom come. And he does so through the institutional visible church. And that church does so by its commitment to the instituted means of grace. And it just doesn't chase fads. It just resists fad chasing. So, I mean, everything about it in spirit was Machen-esque. But I wonder if he was that self-conscious of his connection to the old light and to the old school. I just don't recall reading anything where he tipped his hand on that.
I don't think he, I mean, we have access to a lot more probably church history than he did. And he didn't have, I don't know. I mean, I know he appreciated some of the Southern theologians, that he understood the spirituality of the church, but you know, some of the finer details of polity and worship, those were just not really on the radar. Just like I've written before, there were already female deacons in the church when Machen was getting started. And by the time he left the PCUSA, I believe they had female ruling elders. He didn't write about that. And that just wasn't on his radar. He was fighting for the supernatural character of Christianity and the veracity of the scriptures. So of course and he was fairly narrow in a way. I mean, he was a New Testament scholar. He was focused on the gospel and teaching the languages. Had he lived longer, that's another interesting question. What would have been his take on any number of things? But anyway, no one else has to be interested in that, but we're allowed to be if we want to be. And we are, and we've talked about it for an hour and a half, and not for the first time. So any kind of closing remarks or takeaways or encouragements or discouragements, you know, quit looking up old letters. It's a waste of time. Anything you guys want to, and I know it's a delight to have you three together. You all know each other, but you probably haven't been together like this before. So, and for the 12 people who care, it'll be very meaningful.
Well, let me kiss your behind, Brad, and say I'm grateful for your finding this letter and bringing it to my attention and to others. Of course, I'm kind of biased. I'm a Machen. A Machen boy, but it really is striking to see how he was thinking on the first day of the year in 1925. Even striking to think about him answering letters on that day and what his concerns were. And I'm going to use it at some point. I hope idea of a Presbyterian church for me. It's just a great line.
Well, when the OPC was formed in the Presbyterian Church in America, I think one of the things he said was, you know, at last a true Presbyterian Church, and that's why some crank suggested when they had to rename a few years later that the OPC would be called the True Presbyterian Church of the World, and I think he was actually tipping his cap back to what Machen had said, but. He really did value the church. You know, an interesting question is, you know, did 1919 Machen or pre-World War I Machen value the Presbyterian Church the way he came to? We know that he was not completely bought into even reform, even what Calvinism until the late teens. So he was developing too. But he did become very concerned about his church and the Presbyterian tradition, and he had concerns about evangelicalism and all these things and missions. So to me, it's encouraging that the things we're concerned about, he was concerned about too. We just need to remember there's nothing new under the sun. It'll always manifest differently.
I would just add before Scott and T. David weigh in. But I think there is an earlier Machen, which is not as vigorous and controversial as the later Machen. But I think we need to keep in mind that he was teaching Sunday school at the First Presbyterian Church in Princeton before the war. He was writing Sunday school lessons for the denomination, which I think indicates that his own personal piety was very much oriented around the local congregation and the denomination. That's where he drew his strength and his identity. And then it became more pronounced as controversies wore on.
As a young man, he recited the Shorter Catechism. And right. I guess 150 Bible verses, if I'm understanding correctly, what I just read.
And all the kings of Judah and Israel.
So, I mean, the stuff was there. And as often happens, it takes time for all of that to sort of come together sometime. Right? He's a very thoughtful, sensitive young man, and remarkably honest. Right? There's been all this, or at least some degree of, I don't know how to characterize it, controversy about, you know, why Machen struggled or doubted about whether he should enter ministry or teach at the at Princeton and all of that. And there have been some, I think, some really unhappy suggestions about why that was. But the stuff was there, and over time, in the providence of God, it came together, which is what typically happens, right? How many people, young people, for how many young people does it just, you know, do they sort of arrive fully developed in terms of their theology, piety, and practice? Not very often, it seems to me. So I guess I'm saying we should allow him to be human, because there is a kind of, I guess, mate myth. But I'll end with that.
And Brad, if I can have a closing comment as a former professor, I'd like to make a bibliographical recommendation. Several of you, and probably myself, have mentioned the word confessional in our conversation today. And Dr. Lilbeck did a great service for us all when he and a colleague put together that collection of Reformed confessions. It's got five of them, plus the ecumenical creeds before that. The only one it's missing is the Scots Confession of 1560 among Reformed creeds, but it has the Belgic, the Second Helvetic, Westminster, obviously, the Heidelberg, and the Canons of Dort. So all it's missing is the Scots Confession of 1560. But here's what I rarely recommend with books. I recommend the Kindle version. And the reason is the search feature on that is just so powerful that you've got five of the six Reformed standards. Just pull the Scots Confession in also and search it separately. And you can run searches. And you'll find that, for instance, even the expression Ten Commandments is all over Westminster and only appears once or twice in several of the other ones. The Covenant of Works is an expression not found outside of Westminster. Solemn fastings, which our General Assembly just called upon us all to do, is only mentioned in Second Helvetic and Westminster. It's not a regular ordinance in any of the other four Reformed standards. And so I've just had a gasp with this thing for the last few months that whenever a question occurs to me, I can search five of the six Reformed standards with one search feature, and it searches all of them and brings them in their order. So that's a wonderful service. If I can bend his ear sometime, I'll recommend that they add the Scots Confession of 1560 to it on the second printing. Then you'd have them all there under one roof. And in the Kindle version of it, you can just search it rapidly and just say, you know, did all of the Reformed creeds say this or did they not? I was stunned after our General Assembly called upon presbyteries to designate a particular day to observe a solemn fast when four of the Reformed standards don't even acknowledge fasting as a New Testament ordinance at all. And Hodge denied that it was, and Samuel Miller denied that it was. But working with just Westminster on the few places where Westminster is a little bit eccentric, a little out of round from the others, if you're working just from Westminster, you just assume that all the Reformed standards said what Westminster did, and they didn't. They had their own emphases. The rest of them hadn't been called by Parliament. The rest of them weren't worried about what Parliament would think about them. And so when you can look at all of them, you can find what is generically Reformed and confessional without being restricted only one of those six. So I recommend Dr. Lilbeck's book heartily, and especially in the Kindle version of it.
All right. So you're arguing for a generic, or shall we say, great value Reformed theology. So great value. That's what we're going. The Walmart Reformed. It'll be just fine. It's enough, but we don't want to lose the denominational coloring that Machen talked about.
Yep, that's mine too.
Yep. Well, we want to thank you for joining us, and I did appeal to another eminent Southern Church historian, and he could not make it. And but maybe next time. So. One thing we could throw out there in case there are any independently wealthy persons, all of Machen's letters, I mean, I think few of them are digitized, and it would be a great benefit to the church if somebody would fund the complete digitization of Machen's correspondence and letters. And I'm sure we would learn some things that there would be some good things we learned and maybe even some disturbing things, but we would have it all. So yeah. All right. Well, I'm afraid if you don't like it, this will not be the last Machen show we ever do. And Machen's always on our mind here. Resby's not here, but if he were, he would exhort everyone negatively not to be an Erdman.
What's wrong with you people?